From Iowa Public Radio News, this is Talk of Iowa. I'm Katherine Perkins.
And I'm John Pemble. Today, we're at the Iowa State Fair.
Fair food and health may seem like a contradiction, but we'll hear how these two came together on opening day as part of Iowa's Healthiest State Initiative.
We'll visit an arm wrestling match and talk to a man who has competed for 15 years.
We'll spend time in Pioneer Hall with tradesmen using 19th century techniques.
And we'll hear part of a radio play performed using the same tools from the 1940s.
From the Iowa State Fair. From Iowa Public Radio News, this is Talk of Iowa. I'm Katherine Perkins.
And I'm John Pemble, and we are at the Iowa State Fair.
Come on, don't stop!
Opening ceremonies for the 2012 fair had dignitaries like Governor Terry Branstad, celebrities like Kansas City Chiefs star Eddie Kinnison, and something a little different.
All right, everyone. Welcome to Iowa State Fair. My name is Katie Mullen. I'm your Zumba instructor this morning.
Hundreds of fairgoers joined the Latin-inspired cardio dance party, including Rory Walling, a Goodrill middle schooler in Des Moines who was ready to get his groove on.
It was fun. It was long, and I had no idea what I was doing, but I kind of just went with the flow, and like I'm an awesome dancer and all, so I was like, woo, this is awesome. So I'm a stud.
Zumba instructor Katie Moulton admits she had misgivings about Zumba at the fairgrounds.
I was a little concerned about that, especially with all the food in the background, but I think that Iowa is taking the steps that it needs to take in order to be the healthiest state by, I think it's 2016. So just by that, it's implementing exercise, and you know, the nutrition will come. Once you're exercising and you're feeling great, you're going to be making better choices anyways. So.
The Zumba party was sponsored by Iowa's Healthiest State Initiative, a privately led public effort with the goal of making Iowa the healthiest state by 2016. For years, food vendors at the fair have offered deep-fried or high-sugar options, and this year new items have been added, like the 1,500-calorie German chocolate funnel cake, or the double bacon corn dog, a hot dog wrapped in bacon that's fried, then fried a second time in a bacon bit batter. Rick Juergens is president of the Healthy State Initiative and says exercising at the fair where these high-calorie foods are available may seem like a contradiction.
But at the end of the day, all of us indulge in something from time to time. The fair is one of those times where it's fun and exciting and easy to indulge. But also at the fair, there are healthy food options. And we prepared a brochure that people can collect at the Healthy Estate booth in the Varied Industries buildings or at information booths around the fair that will help people find the healthier options.
State Fair Marketing Director Lori Chappell says while the fair has many decadent foods, consumers need to be mindful as they make choices about what they eat.
There are smart ways to have those types of foods, and they do have their role. You probably won't eat all 365 days a double bacon corn dog, but having them one or a few times during the 11-day stretch of the fair, you know, as long as you're adding the right things to your diet and walking around and hydrating and doing those things, it can fit in.
This year, for the first time, an iPhone app is available to help find food at the fair.
You can find out all types of information, including calories of the foods that you're thinking about eating or maybe have already eaten, and it will also let you know how much walking you need to do to burn those calories off. So that particular app was in partnership with the Healthy Estate Initiative, so that we're putting that twist on fair food of, okay, so you've eaten it, what can you do now about it?
Juergens says state fair leaders have been very cooperative.
And I was just talking to some of the leaders of the fair here, thanking them for when we approach them about creating the food guides, they were very excited about helping. And I thought that was a great sign. And when opening day, the main concourse is flooded with people doing a Zumba, exercising, that's a great sign. There are a lot of people in Iowa and at the fair that are excited about trying to make Iowa the healthiest state. and themselves the healthiest people.
Before the Healthiest State Initiative was launched a year ago, Iowa ranked 19th in the nation. Now, the state has climbed to 16th. What do you like to eat when you're at the Iowa State Fair?
My name is Brain Brown, and when I come to the fair, I have to have a foot-long corn dog.
My name is Crystal Halstead, and every year I come to the fair, I have to eat the mini donuts.
My name is Sharon Smith, and every year when I come to the fair, I have to have the fresh lemonade shake-ups because there's no lemonade better.
My name is Megan Richardson, and my favorite thing to get at the fair would probably be the blooming onion.
My name is John, and the food I have to eat before I leave the state fair is a grinder.
Hi, my name is Rochelle Carrington, and I always have to have the turkey leg. It's very good.
My name is Becky Stainhook, and every year at the Iowa State Fair, I have to have a corn dog.
Hi, my name is Kelly McGinnis, and I have to have pineapple ice cream.
Hi, my name is Hunter. Before I leave the fair, I have to eat a peppermint bar.
My name is Caleb Noel, and I have to have the double bacon corn dog before I leave the fair because it has bacon and it's a corn dog.
I'm Sydney Mitchell, and every time we come to the fair, we have to have Bowder's ice cream. I like the chocolate kind.
Some plan their day at the fair based on a single event, like Bob Chance from Cambridge, who comes to compete in the Monster Arm Wrestling Contest. This year, Chance has brought a relative to compete for the first time. They are in the media center of a cattle barn, sitting at one of two wrestling machines. Chance explains how the device works.
Elbow on the pad, hands on the pegs, seat on the seat, and it's going to be a 3-minute match. And you're going to watch this mark right here. Try to keep it on your side of the mark as long as you can for the 3 minutes.
So. Instead of touching hands, a rubber-coated metal handlebar is used to prevent twisting and slipping, reducing the possibility of a broken wrist or arm. Most of these matches end when one person pins the other, but it can also be won by holding an opponent past the middle mark for the longest period of time in the 3 minutes allowed. With a $20 entry fee, anyone can sign up before the matches start. This is Bob Chance's 15th consecutive year competing at the state fair.
When is it your turn to go up and wrestle?
When they call one of those two numbers.
You're in two classes, or you just register twice?
Right and left, and both in middleweight. So,
what's your best hand?
Which one are you best at?
I think my right, but my left's getting better. Yep.
Chance's number is called to wrestle at table two. He grabs the handle while resting his elbow on a soft, circular pad. The height of this pad is adjusted by a few millimeters until Chance finds the right distance from the top of the handlebar to where his elbow will dig in. During the match, the competitor's upper body cannot touch their arm. Two referees hover over the table as Chance's first match of the day begins.
Ready, 3, 2, 1, wrestle!
Chance is pinned and loses in 5 seconds. The men shake hands.
So sometimes they go fast.
Yes, they do. hard guy to slow down there.
What arm were you using there?
Right hand. I needed to come up just a little bit higher so I can slow down his initial surge there. But, yeah, out of breath. Just that quick. Oh,
when
good
you,
match, though.
Now, but how many times do you go?
It's double elimination, so at least two matches in each hand for me. Right now, I go over on the loser's side, and I work my way back to the winner's side, so hopefully. And then, they just go on the bracket system over there till you've been eliminated twice. And
while Chance waits for his next round, his relative, Chad Cordy, a first-time competitor here, is close to winning. Cordy is in the heavyweight class, and his opponent is a former state fair arm wrestling champion. Cordy's face is red, and he is silent as he pushes toward victory while his opponent groans.
2:30, 2.5 minutes, 30 seconds left, gentlemen.
Come on, Healy.
Go, go, go!
At the last second, the tide changes for Cody, and he loses. It's his second loss, and he can no longer compete.
So it's double elimination, and you almost made it to the last.
Just about made it, yeah. I was working against myself there. You know, I got a very large arm reach, and the guy that I was fighting in competition with there, you know, he's got a really short base reach, so it's difficult to match up with each other, and he just got the upper hand on me. I mean, he's a veteran, you know, 35 years since the place is going, so I feel fortunate. You know, I took on the guy for 3 minutes that's been doing it for 35 years, and I took the guy that was a reigning champ last year, and so I guess I took on the best two top dogs my first year in, so I can't complain too much.
As the afternoon continues, Bob Chance is losing more than winning. He loses his last match of the day. In the past, Chance has come in first place for the middleweight, but this year he finishes third for his right hand and second for his left.
What's it like winning and losing in the same day, back and forth?
I don't know. There's a lot of good sportsmanship involved. You know how the other guys, how strong they are, what their techniques are, and you know if you got a chance or not, but you always got that drive to try to slow the tough ones down. Yeah. But winning, yeah, it's obviously great. I mean, it's not like the Olympics probably, but it feels good. Losing, you just take it with a grain of salt and try to get better next time. So
how many younger people are getting involved in this activity, this sport, this competition?
It's getting to be more younger than older. So they're getting a lot younger. Some of the older wrestlers' daughters, like that one right there, are in it now, and it's just hard to believe, and they're getting younger and stronger, throw more bells. Hey, I don't know what it is, but yeah, a lot younger now.
Usually it means the sport's growing if younger people are starting to take over.
Yes. Yeah, it is growing. 4 years ago was our 30 year here, and we had 80 contestants, you know, stretched out between all the weight classes, but that was a long day of arm wrestling.
How many people do you think were here today competing, roughly?
I would say 55, maybe 60 at the most. Yeah. So it's down a little bit this year. I don't know why, but we usually have a pretty good showing.
During the year, Chance competes at a handful of monster wrestling stops held at county fairs and taverns, and plans to continue competing at the state fair next year.
You're listening to a special edition of Talk of Iowa at the Iowa State Fair. Still to come, the Agriculture Building is abuzz as the Iowa Honey Producers Association celebrates its centennial. And we head up the hill to Pioneer Hall, where a local theater group creates radio drama. Stay with us on Iowa Public Radio.
This is Talk of Iowa. I'm John Pimble.
And I'm Catherine Perkins. The trip up to Pioneer Hall at the Iowa State Fair is like stepping back in time. The old barn hosts contests for fiddlers and banjo players. Working along to the music are pioneer tradesmen demonstrating and selling their wares. Robbie Peterson owns RVP 1875 in Jefferson, a museum where he builds historical furniture using the tools and techniques of the time period.
We go as far as to chop the tree down with an axe and hand plane and saw the boards. What I'm doing right now is I've got a rough sawn board that's air dried for a few years and put it in the vise and run a joiner plane, which is a long straight plane that will find the high spots on the edge of a board. So as soon as we have a long straight edge on that board, then I can put a square on it and cut it to length.
Peterson is working on a settle table, which is a bench with a back that flips down to become a dining room table. He plans to do 3 separate pieces of furniture during the fair.
It's fun. We have people, especially like the people who camp here and they come through the fair every day. We get those regular people who, they want to check on your progress. And so, you know, I can't just, I'm not in the mood today, you know, because those people are going to come and they'll be like, well, you had 12 hours since I last saw you and that's all the farther you got.
Peterson sells the pieces to fund the museum, where he hosts school groups and offers apprenticeships. Pricing is based on history, too, using the rate of inflation and factoring in the hardness of the wood. He says the fair is a good way to get the word out about the museum and educate people about the time period.
When I'm in my home, my shop there in Jefferson, I'd say 90% of the time we're building, and then 10%, you know, people come in, and I'll give them a little tour, or we talk about pieces or tools. Here's just the opposite. You know, there's always 20 people in front of you that want a little show, and they not only want to ask questions and have you tell them about what you're doing, but they want to see you working at the same time.
Just a few steps away, Gerald Durbin is sewing a Confederate sack coat on an old treadle sewing machine.
Most of the units back then wore a regimental sack coat. Some units also wore a shell jacket, which is a waistcoat. This one here is a little bit longer, hitch it below the waist. And some of them had trim on them, collar and cuffs, and some of them were just plain. The one I'm working on right now is just a plain coat.
Durbin owns Coon River Mercantile in Des Moines, which manufactures clothing from 1860 to 1880 for reenactors, museums, and the movies.
We've done Gettysburg, Gods and Generals, Sweet Home Alabama, 310 to Yuma. The last one we done was that one movie, Abraham Lincoln Vampire Hunters. It really wasn't a big hit at the box office, but I got the check, so that's all I care about.
At the fair, he goes old school, pumping a pedal to run the machine as he's done for the past 7 years. And on the other side of the hall, Stephen White is turning the handle on a fan that's blowing air through his forge. He's the veteran, blacksmithing at the state fair for more than 20 years. In that time, he's had his share of questions.
Is that a real fire? I've had that one. And we do, when it's quiet, we'll let kids come in and work. Can't even count them anymore, how many have come in here.
White makes utensils, hardware, and what he calls trinkets and junk to sell at the fair. But he doesn't have much to say about the process.
The blacksmith saying is, get it hot, hit it hard, quit when it's done.
Sound advice, like so many other bits of blacksmithing wisdom.
The saying, too many irons in the fire, that comes from blacksmiths. They might have two or three different things going, and one of them will get burned up, and that's what that saying comes from. Losing your temper, that's also a blacksmith expression, has to do with the hardening of the steel, and then, of course, strike while the iron's hot.
Which for fairgoers is right now, in Pioneer Hall, if you want to see the trades of a time long since past.
Do you know what Miss Gulch said she was going to do to Toto?
The main stage in Pioneer Hall features all kinds of acoustic performance, including drama.
Look, Miss Gulch!
Foley artists shake large cans filled with hard objects and rub fabric together to create live sound effects for The Wizard of Oz. In this scene, a tornado descends on a house in Kansas, taking the main character Dorothy and her dog Toto to a place called Oz.
Toto, look! There's a big bubble coming down the street, and there's someone inside it, a lady, and she's stepping out of it. Oh, now I know we're not in Kansas.
This is the Final Act Ensemble Radio Players, a group from the Des Moines Playhouse that have been performing classic radio plays for 7 years. Kathy Pingle is the ensemble's director and the Des Moines Playhouse's director of education. Pingle says the group began 7 years ago during a 6-week class for senior citizens.
After that first class, the group was just so cohesive, they said, well, can't we sign up for another 6 weeks? Yes. And then after they'd written their first radio play, it was like, well, can't we go out and perform that? So basically this was coerced by our volunteers' interest in both radio performance and the outreach to the community. And we're a small enough group that we can fit in almost anywhere. A smallest elementary school classroom all the way to Pioneer Hall. We've performed at Terrible's Casino, at high school reunions, we perform for conferences.
Lake Okoboji.
I think we've passed our 120th performance as a group, so it's all worked out.
Susie McCallie is a Final Act Ensemble Foley artist. She works in front of the actors, creating sound effects with ordinary objects.
We have a thunder sheet that John, one of our members, made out of metal. And we have just an empty box with hit it with a knitting needle. We use cellophane for the fire and the little bubble wrap to make the crackling of the fire. I'm trying to think quickly. We have a crash box.
There's a wind machine. There's a crash box. There's a walking board. And then some of the stuff we just kind of get from the basement, if it sounds right.
You know, or the workroom, the husband's tool table or something like that. It's amazing. Once you start looking for sound effects, you're running around the house kind of banging on this or seeing what this sound, and it's amazing some of the things that you can come up with that end up really working.
A heart. It is a heart.
Just remember that a heart is not judged by how much you love, but by how much you are loved.
Well, listen, it ticks.
What is the connection that you have with an audience while doing radio theater versus a play at the Des Moines Playhouse with sets?
Even if it's just a radio show, it's still a visual experience. And so there's the way that we enjoy it as we're performing it. And that draws the audience in. And also, I think the sound effects table is something different, something that people don't usually see anymore. Those Foley artists are really well hidden anymore. And so that's kind of like the machinery of the play. And the kids really, really like that. So we're animated. We have a working portion of it. And we do every once in a while slip in something like when Toto is announced, we all gesture over there. We're all involved in it. So the whole idea is to keep it lively looking, even though it's an auditory experience.
This is radio from 70, 80 years ago. This is a kind of drama that was common. It's very rare now. How do you find the newer audiences relating to what you're doing, something that they may have never heard before?
Well, it's true that our audience that had direct experience with that kind of radio is diminishing. But for kids, it's like storytelling, except for instead of one storyteller, there are 18. And so radio has often been described as theater of the mind, and it's still really successful in that regard.
Kathy Pingle says the group will continue performing radio plays from the 1940s like The Shadow, Easy Aces, A Christmas Carol, as well as make their own adaptations of popular stories like Alice in Wonderland.
The Iowa Honey Producers are celebrating 100 years at the State Fair with the usual offerings in the Agriculture Building, honey lemonade, candle rolling.
And that is a very good-looking candle.
Thank you.
Good job.
And a recognition from Iowa Secretary of Agriculture, Bill Northey.
There's not many associations that have been around 100 years. In fact, we're not actually sure that there's any others in Iowa right now. There's fruit and vegetable growers. It goes back a long ways as well. But even some of our major groups, we think of the corn growers and soybeans and the cattlemen and pork producers, those don't go back that far. But the Iowa Honey Producers does.
The 500 or so members of the association are also celebrating what looks to be a bumper crop, according to state apiarist Andy Joseph.
When white sweet clover hit this year, it was like someone opened a faucet and just started pouring nectar into our hives, and it's been a great season. And again, I hate to say that too loud in some place like the State Fair, because so many people, you know, are having failing crops and really struggling, but hot and dry equals a really good year for beekeepers generally.
Joseph says in an average year, an Iowa beekeeper can get about 60 pounds, or about a 5-gallon bucket, of honey per hive or colony. This year, he's guessing beekeepers will get 80 to 90 pounds. But it's not all good news.
You know, there is that other darker side of this all. We still have all the same pests and parasites and diseases and viruses and on, you know, this whole host of issues and maladies. It's all very much a real part of beekeeping, and we learn continuously. And for the larger issues, colony collapse disorder and some of these bigger problems, you know, we're really just kind of trying to hold out, wait for answers from researchers, maybe some suggestions, things that we can do to limit it. And in the meantime, we just keep going as strong as we can.
Colony collapse disorder is a relatively new phenomenon. Bees simply disappear. Joseph says the worst story he's heard was of a beekeeper in eastern Iowa who lost more than 5,000 colonies. He opened up hive after hive, only to find a tiny cluster of dead bees. The cause of colony collapse disorder is unknown, but Iowa Honey Producers past president Donna Brahms says it's likely a combination of factors.
Cities are growing, farmers are farming fence row to fence row. They're getting rid of the natural habitat of the honeybees, and so their diet is having to change. Their nutrition is one of the critical items of them, because then they are more susceptible to diseases if they don't have the proper nutrition. And we do use an awful lot of chemicals in this country, and so a lot of the insecticides are encroaching on the ability for a honeybee to survive.
The problem extends beyond honey producers. Brahm says every third bite you eat is thanks to pollination that bees provide for crops. But Joseph says the horror stories seem to be fueling interest.
Our beginner beekeeping classes that we offer through the Honey Producers Association are huge. I wouldn't say full. There's always room for anybody out there. But, you know, our numbers have skyrocketed in these last few years. And I think it's because people just want to get involved and do what they can and kind of keep a finger on the pulse.
And if visitors to the hives on display at the Honey Producers booth are any indication, bees still capture the imagination.
Did you learn something about bees today?
Yes, very much so. I'd never seen a queen bee, and he showed us how to pick it out. It's beautiful.
Bees go out and the girl bees circle around the queen bee.
The Iowa Honey Producers Youth Program offers education, a colony of bees, and all the equipment. Participants get to keep it if they meet all the program requirements. And it's this future generation of beekeepers that will keep Iowa Honey Producers buzzing for another 100 years. Just down the street, another insect is attracting attention. A big green tent sits on the north end of the fairgrounds, enticing young and old with flashes of orange and black. The butterfly house is flying more than 2,000 monarch butterflies inside the netting.
Now, how do I get this butterfly off me? This guy likes me.
Butterfly attack.
They're everywhere, and it's amazing how you can get so many butterflies in one spot.
South of the tent, at the Animal Learning Center, Kathleen Zeman is doing daily presentations and tagging monarchs before the butterflies embark on their southern migration to Mexico.
Butterflies of Iowa usually tags between 400 and 500 butterflies a year. We've had a dozen of ours return. It always amazes me that something I held in my hand flew 2,000 miles to Mexico. And other times, the first time I ever tagged, mine went all the way to Urbandale.
So tell me a little bit about tagging.
Monarch tagging is headed up by the University of Kansas, the Monarch Watch Program. They started, I don't even know how many years ago they started. I've been tagging about 15 years, so at least before then. And the idea is you tag every monarch you see after the 1st of August. And to see what's happening during that migration, to follow the migration. The overwintering sites in Mexico weren't found until the late 60s. So it's a relatively new adventure for scientists and for butterfly people. The tags are about the size of a paper punch hole. They have a special adhesive on the back of them designed by 3M so that they stick to the butterfly wing, and they do not interfere with the balance of the butterfly. They're put on the back dorsal wing next to the body, and they're going to do that now. Hold the butterfly down with one finger, like that. And then with your other finger, I want you to press that tag into place. Press it down. Okay, very good. Let Lindsay record the number, and then she's going to give it back to you, and I want you to hold it until it's time to release, okay? So then we record the number of the tag with the university, and then they track it, recovery of the tag.
And recovery works just if they find a butterfly?
Yeah, if people can find tagged monarchs, they can report it. They send people down after the 1st of the year and collect tags. They offer a reward system to the locals. The idea is to give the locals a cash crop so they don't take logging from the overwintering site, which has been an issue. Okay, where's my two girls? All right, you guys stand here with me. Let's get over here. There's an old Indian legend that says if you capture a butterfly and whisper a wish to it and set the butterfly free, The butterfly will take your wish to the Great Spirit, and because you stayed in harmony with nature, the Great Spirit will grant your wish. So everybody close their eyes real quick and make a wish. And on the count of three, I want you two to throw the butterfly up in the air. Are you ready? One, two, three. Up. There they go.
What kind of reaction are you getting to the idea of tagging and releasing here at the fair?
The ones that come and sit through it are just amazed, just like you. It's kind of like, is this really true? But and the kids love it. You know, I try to include the kids as much as I can. But I think people are surprised. It's not unusual for groups that I speak to be completely amazed that, and you know, they've never noticed butterflies, and all of a sudden they're seeing butterflies everywhere, which is what I want.
You're listening to Talk of Iowa from Iowa Public Radio News. Coming up, we hear about a fungus that's endangering the lives of bats, a group of special square dancers, plus a half-pound pigeon wins first place. I'm Katherine Perkins with John Pemble, and we're at the Iowa State Fair on Iowa Public Radio. This is Talk of Iowa. I'm Katherine Perkins.
And I'm John Pemble, and we are at the Iowa State Fair. Pella Wildlife Company estimate bats save Iowa farmers $1.7 billion on pesticides each year. They're at the fair to help prevent bat deaths. At the Maytag Family Theater, Iowa Public Radio's Claire Roth is with the CEO of Pella Wildlife Company, Ron DeArmond, while he holds a big brown bat.
This is the biggest bat we have in our state.
It's not very big.
No.
Everyone is crowding around Spalding, a big brown bat that, despite his name, is only 2.5 inches tall. Ron DeArmond, CEO of Pella Wildlife Company, named him after the tennis rackets that are too often used against his kind in Iowa homes. Two other wildlife ambassadors, as DeArmond calls them, Prince and Wilson, are hanging upside down in a cage behind him as he explains the invasive fungus that's threatening their lives.
Bats are the number one conservation issue in North America. It's a totally invasive species, white nose syndrome, so mortality rate's very high, about 90%. Unfortunately, it was just confirmed in Iowa this year. So we're going to have a big decrease in our bat population. According to U.S. Fish and Wildlife Service, they feel they're just monitoring the extinction of a species. It's that bad.
Pat Mulder of Centerville says bats have fascinated him since he was a child, growing up on a farm.
We had the streetlight, of course, which attracted a lot of bats in our stuff. It heard a little bit about the white nose, and I wanted to know what else we could do about it and that kind of thing, if there was any help we could give for that process. So,
Pella Wildlife says one way for people like Pat to help is to build bat houses. Travis Wilkinson demonstrates how to build a wooden bat house not much larger than a textbook.
Believe it or not, a bat box this size can actually hold anywhere from 100 to 150 bats. This is not a very big opening. They are very good at cramming into very small locations. They need only something as small as a quarter of an inch.
And while those houses will give the bats more places to live, allow them to spread out, and slow the transmission of the fungus, there's no real solution to white nose syndrome.
But you're talking a fungus, you're talking bat or cave ecosystems, so you just can't spray fungicide in there to kill the fungus because you would destroy the ecosystem. So it's one of those things that basically is being monitored. If they could find a way to treat just the bats, I'm sure that would be the ideal situation, but it's just not happening. And this disease continues to march across North America.
DeArmond says the best case scenario is that they'll regenerate the population in a century. The worst case? The North America bat population will be eradicated in 10 years. I'm Claire Roth, Iowa Public Radio News.
Janine Bennett is a retired woman from Iowa City. She's lived there for 42 years, and this is the first time she has been at the Iowa State Fair.
I've been to the Illinois State Fair a lot because we're from Illinois. So I've been to Springfield, and I guess I thought this was going to be the same type. You know, and this one I think is much more elaborate.
Bennett is in the poultry building and says she expected to see the kind of pigeons that dwell in cities and is surprised at the beauty of the birds on display.
I like the ones with the feathers on their feet, several of those, And then the pale pastel ones, they're white with a very light kind of mauve-y, beige-y wing. And then there's a beautiful brown and white one caught my eye. It has kind of, it looks like a headdress of feathers. Very, very pretty. A cinnamon brown and white.
There are 235 pigeons representing 31 varieties in the poultry building this year. Only a few of these birds are eligible for the lightest and heaviest pigeon contest. Pigeon Superintendent Dave Fulsky says he can tell just by looking at these birds the ones that are finalists to be weighed.
Okay, these are the giant runts. These are probably the birds that someone will bring, or they will bring up to get weighed. And as far as looking at them, you can't really tell if they're going to win or not. And then the smallest one will probably be these Portuguese tumblers.
The pigeons are here for a shorter period of time. They're not here the whole fair. How long are pigeons here?
Okay, they come in, start coming in this afternoon on Monday, and they are here until tomorrow evening, which is Tuesday at 6 o'clock. They're released.
When these birds are on display at a fair or a competition, what happens to them? What's their longevity? Are they someone's pet?
Oh, yeah, I've heard that, or I have had myself personally, have had birds live up to 10, 15 years old. And a lot of your fairgoers will come in here and want to buy one or two birds that they want to take home and put in a canary cage or parakeet cage, and you just keep it right in the house.
Where do you live when you're not at the fair?
Where do I live? I live in Tripola, Iowa, which is about 30 miles north of Waterloo, and I just work in a factory like everybody else, and I enjoy my pigeons. My great-grandfather was a big pigeon fancier, and I guess it just kind of carried over, and I'm trying to get either my grandson or one of my sons to get involved in it. It's a great hobby to go out and just sit and watch them and listen to them and see how they perform and how they act when they're in your loft.
Dave Fulsky calls for the pigeons to be weighed. Within 10 minutes, he announces the winners. The lightest is a half-pound Portuguese tumbler, and the heaviest is a giant runt weighing 2 pounds. The heaviest pigeon winners say the trick to keeping the weight on the bird is to add cat food to the pigeon feed. On Tuesday evening, all pigeons are removed from the building except for the lightest and heaviest, where they will remain in their cage, decorated with a purple prize ribbon, as the rabbit contests begin.
This year's Iowa State Fair coincides with the 150th anniversary of Union Pacific Railroad, and one of the fair's longtime attractions, the Railroad Museum, is helping celebrate the milestone. The Central Iowa Railroad Club's members spent 6 years building the display. The model train runs the length of the building and lays out typical Iowa scenes, a drive-in movie theater, Rag Bry, and a portion of the Kate Shelley Bridge. It's been a labor of love for club president Ron Graham.
How much time have I personally done? Ask my wife. We normally meet on Tuesday nights as a work night. But Tuesdays, Thursdays, and weekends are just work.
Graham says there are a lot of Union Pacific fans among his members, himself included. So when they heard Union Pacific was sponsoring the first day of the fair, the Central Iowa Railroad Club ran all UP trains for the day. A grant from Union Pacific will help with expanding the model in the coming years, and Graham's excitement shows on his face.
I grew up in Arkansas, and my brother and I used to run down the road, climb under the trestle, and let the steam locomotives run across. So I've loved trains since I was a little kid. You know, some guys like hot rods, some guys like motorcycles, and we happen to just love trains.
And for train lovers, this year's fair offered a special opportunity. For 4 days, the actual 844 steam locomotive and 3 Union Pacific cars were parked a block from the fairgrounds and open to visitors. Brenda Mainwaring is Union Pacific's Director of Public Affairs for Iowa and Nebraska.
It was the last steam locomotive that was built for the Union Pacific, and it was never retired. As far as we know, it's the only steam locomotive in the nation that was never taken out of service. It's a huge piece of machinery, and that's one of the other cool reasons to have it at the fair, because you think of the fair and you think of all this agricultural machinery, and it's a pretty cool thing to see.
Mainwaring says the train has had a steady stream of foot traffic.
It's been busy all day. We've had lots of folks that have been coming down. It's been great to see lots of kids who have never seen a steam locomotive before, lots of grandparents who can reminisce with them about their experiences with steam and with passenger travel. It's a lot of fun to see people experience the railroad.
Mary Parent walked down the block and is impressed.
It's just amazing. We just thought it was fantastic. You can actually purchase tickets in July of every year to ride this from Denver to Cheyenne. And so that's on my dream list. That's on my bucket list.
Four girls promenade inside. Back home, join your hands and servalettes.
Barry Peck began square dance calling 2 years ago for the Star Spangled Swingers. The Swingers is a group for mentally challenged adults, and they dance at the state fair every year. Peck says square dancing is pretty complex and not easy to learn.
Square dancing takes like 15 to 20 weeks to go through all the lessons. That's 2 hours a week. This group, we work about an hour and a half a month, so we can't get into all the more complicated moves, so we just keep everything just kind of simple so they can just dance it and enjoy it and not have to think a lot about the moves.
One of the dancers, Cindy Kiesler, has been with the group since 1985 when her mother, the late Phyllis Van Dulsum, was the caller. Kiesler says she enjoys the Star Spangled Swingers because it allows her to dance to the music she likes with her friends. What are some of the hardest dance moves for you?
It used to be Squaresville. It was, but now it's fairly easy. It's fairly easy, yes.
Cindy Kiesler and Lori Thomas are in their late 50s and are two of the dancers who've been with the group the longest. Thomas says the caller often asks them to help some of the dancers learn if they are new or having a hard time with some of the steps.
You kind of teach them with the music, and when he calls something real easy or hard, you kind of have to follow along.
And you seem to have it down really well.
Yes, I do.
We like to come out to the people, and it's very relaxed here. And yeah. I do this now as a tribute to my mother, Phyllis Van Dulsum. So, yeah, if it wasn't for her, I wouldn't be dancing right now.
When Kiesler's mom died in 1994, Jane Blythe and her husband began running the group.
My daughter is a member of the Star Spangled Swingers. So that is really how we started. So 18 years later, here we are. They still have to put up with this, don't you, dancers?
Yes.
It's sometimes hard to find activities and social activities for people that are mentally challenged. When you're looking for ways to have your daughter communicate with people when she was a young adult, was this one outlet that kind of found a common ground in a social spot that works?
My daughter was actually her latter part of high school when she joined the group, so a lot of these have been dancing longer. That like Cindy and Lori, they've been a lot longer than what my daughter has. So we just happened to stumble across this through the ARC. It was the ARC at that time, Association of Retarded Citizens at that time. So we just happened to stumble onto this activity, and then that's when she joined the group. But a lot of these had been dancing for a number of years.
It seems that everybody's really happy.
Oh, they love it. It's their thing. We danced at the Variety Club Telethon. That's our first dance of the year. And then we go to nursing homes, retirement centers. This is another big event, the state fair every year, and they absolutely love it. But we get more reward from being the directors than they do from us, because we just love each and every one of them, and they touch our hearts in such a special way.
And you want to keep doing it?
Well, as long as they'll have me.
We want
want you.
We want you, Jay.
Oh, as long as we can. Yeah, my husband and I love it. So we will do it as long as we're able.
Up to the middle and back with a big old shout. Out of your barbers. Out of your corners. Once again, ladies and gentlemen, the Star Spangled Swingers. Give them a big hand.
There are a lot of things you can count on seeing at the Iowa State Fair. Livestock, the butter cow, and, in a presidential year, politicians.
Congressman Paul Ryan came to the fairgrounds to give a speech the day after being named as presumptive Republican presidential nominee Mitt Romney's running mate.
Later that same evening, President Obama stopped at the fair as he was making a series of campaign stops across the state.
He didn't give a speech. But as he was walking down a street blocked off by Secret Service and the Iowa State Patrol,
Mr. President, we love you.
How are you?
I am good. How are you, sir?
That's Gina McClellan from Carlisle shouting, "We love you," to the president. It gets his attention, and he approaches McClellan to give her a hug.
He said that he could hear me from across the street yelling that I loved him and came over and told me I deserved a hug. Oh, I could have fainted. It was awesome. And he smells really good. You know what's funny about that? I'm a conservative, but I don't know. I might go the other way. He smelled that good. Thank you.
Thank you.
The president shakes hands, poses for pictures, and enters a beer tent where he buys a large beer for himself and 10 beers for people around him. The mood is light as the crowd chants, "Four more beers." President Obama is the fourth sitting president to visit the Iowa State Fair.
The last president to visit was in 2002 from President George W. Bush. Prior to that, President Gerald Ford was here in 1975, and President Dwight Eisenhower was the first commander-in-chief to visit in 1954.
You're listening to a special edition of Talk of Iowa from the Iowa State Fair. I'm Katherine Perkins.
And I'm John Pimble. Today's program features highlights from our 5 days at the Iowa State Fair. We received assistance from Claire Roth, Pat Blank, and Sonia Dirks.
The executive producer of our talk shows is Jeff Schmidt. You can download today's Talk of Iowa from our website, iowapublicradio.org.
Talk of Iowa is a production of Iowa Public Radio News. This is Iowa Public Radio.